Thank you so very first of all, I'd like to thank the opportunity to the organization committee, especially to Mr. Sanfilippo, Emilio Sanfilippo, who reached to me and asked to give this talk, and I was really pleased and happy to make it happen. I recently moved to a new position here at Senckenberg, the Entomological Institute here in Germany. As you can see, my background is empty because I literally started a few weeks ago. But today I want to talk a little bit of primary data and entomological collections to you. And I'm aware that this conference has many people with many different backgrounds. So I'm going to try to make it a little bit more comprehensible for anyone that is outside the biological field. So, well, let's see and let's start. So I'll talk a little bit about my background. I'm an entomologist. I'm also a distribution ecologist. And since the beginning of my career, I've been very focused on working with beetles. And I mean, you can see clearly here in the slide how beautiful they are. They have all sorts of shapes and forms and colors. I'm not focused on all beetles, but mostly on leaf beetles, which are Phytophagous beetles. They eat leaves. And besides being very charming with these amazing colors and shapes, they are very interesting biologically and ecologically. So they can also present, this family presents maternal care, where the adult care for the immature larvae. They can also present different kinds of mimicry, like mimicking the shapes of their host plants. Here you can see a beetle with a spine form, Elytra, mimicking the shape of a gall on a leaf. And they also present very interesting defense mechanisms, such as here you see the fecal shield. And under this shield, you can actually find the immature, the larva. And this shield is composed by inserts, like skins of last inserts, and also feces. And it works basically as a chemical detractor and also mechanical detractor to predators. And to understand this amazing group, I unite taxonomy, phylogeny, and bioinformatics, where my interest is actually in the intersection of all these areas, leading us to the macroevolution, so where I can understand, which allows me to understand the evolution of different characters, different behaviors, and different questions throughout the tree of life of this group, and also to macroecology, and focusing mostly on the understanding of how the environment interacts with the morphological, distributional and morphological aspects of this amazing group. And most of my work is collection-based, which means I need the collection, entomological collections, to obtain the information regarding morphology, distribution, ecology, and that allows me to kind of connect all the dots within the questions for the questions I have about this group. So I unite information regarding morphology, which allows me to go into the phylogenetic field, which also allows me through distribution records understand the environmental space and how this interacts with different processes and patterns that we might see in the group. And this also leads me to understanding a little bit about the interactions between the group itself, but also with them and their host plant and other predators, competitors that they might have. So collection is very important for my work, and that's why I'm so motivated as a curator to also make this data available, extract this data and make it available for usage. I'm not sure if everyone is aware, but biological collections are foundational across many research fields, and they allow us to document and describe populations, species, and their tremendous, you know, amazing diversity. And this allows us also to assess some questions that we have regarding public health, agriculture, food security, also monitoring environmental contamination. And besides knowing the past, it also allows us to know the present and the future, understanding the distribution patterns in different aspects, different areas, invasive species. So the data that we hold in biological collections is very precious and is very important, not only to keep them, but also allow others and make it to use it and make it more accessible. So, as I said, I work with entomology and I work with beetles, which is an amazing group and very diverse. And I'm a very avid Star Trek fan, every time the Star Trek starts, they start with this classic sentence where they say space, the final frontier. But when you think about, actually entomology would be a little bit closer to the final frontier. So entomology, insects, they present more than between 900,000 to 1 million species, which making them comprise around 50% of all the eukaryotes. So eukaryotes are the organisms that have cells with nucleus enclosed within membranes. So they are very, very diverse. And not only this, they are very, and not only this, but because of that, they are also very important as a functional group. They are present in most all trophic chains, and they are essential for the functionality of the biodiversity that we see nowadays. Thus, the conservation is critical to the ecological and evolutionary process that drive and maintain the diversity of terrestrial ecological systems basically everywhere. Going back to collections, I bet that many people don't understand, they have this view of entomological collection where the insects are kept, well kept in drawers, they're clean, and they usually, and here is a very classic way of storing insects. For example, you have basically the life, where it was collected, who described. It's all described in these little papers that are attached to them, called labels, entomological labels. They are attached under the individual in the collection. And, you know, it's very common to think that also the writing and the information that you have in the label is very easy to understand. So this is the view that many out of the field of entomology have of the entomological collections. But actually, this is the very frequent case we have. This is a entomological drawer found in the one of many in the entomological collection of the Senac in Hamburg in the Natural History Museum now. And this is very common. The amounts are so big that at some point there is no organization because there is no one to identify. And thus, the collection becomes more and more cluttered. And not only this, the specimens also become a little bit more challenging to work with. And you see growth of different of mold associated with the pins that are of bad quality, usually because you have to mount many specimens that are collected in each field trip. And then you also have mountings that are all to be like three specimens, sometimes more than three specimens on the same pin. So to take care of this, you have to replace all of that. You have to curate this well. And not only this, as I said before, the labels are very frequently illegible. You can't read them. This is an example. These are just a few examples. This one is very interesting. It's basically a book under on the small label. But here's an example of usage of science citizen to citizen science to actually help us understand what's on the label. The problem is so critical that we need actually help, external help most often to understand what's written on the label. And then we go to the part of digitization. So it's very frequent that you hear people saying we need to digitize the collection, we need to make it more accessible. Okay, so we try to make them accessible, but it's not a very easy task. As you can see, there are just a few challenges I cited a few minutes ago. And today I'm gonna try to give you an idea of the digitization process that we're going through here in our institute. And just to demonstrate how hard this can be. So I'll give a little bit of the background of the institute because it's very old, and this will help you understand how we became to be what we are, and how our collection became so rich in specimens. So the story started in 1886. Dr. Gustav Kratz started the institute, which was called German Entomological National Museum. Then in 1911, it became the German Entomological Museum. In 1920, it became the German Entomological Institute. And during World War II, we had to move to Mecklenburg, which is another city nearby Berlin, because of the war and because of the bombarding. Münchenberg, where the institute is actually located nowadays, it was right in the middle between Poland and Germany, so we had to move somewhere else. So the institute was moved to Mecklenburg, then to Friedrichshagen in 1950. In 1951, it became the German Academy of Agricultural Sciences. In 63, after the World War, we went to Eberswalde, which is 40 kilometers from here. Then in 1971, we became the Division of Taxonomy of Insects. And after the German unification, we became the German Entomological Institute. From 1992 to 1993, we were associated with a project in CAI. And in 1994, we became actually a part of a program inside the University of Applied Science in Eberswalde. Then in 1997, we were registered again as the German Entomological Institute, the DEI. In 2000, we became part of the Department of the Center of Agricultural Sciences. In 2008, ZALF, which is the Agricultural Center of Agricultural Science here, in their evaluation, they understood that we were not really working with applying our knowledge to agricultural purposes, but mostly on systematics and taxonomy. So in 2009, Senckenberg included the DEI into their group. So nowadays we are, and nowadays we're still under Senckenberg, we are one of the most important entomological collections here in Germany, and our library is one of the most complete libraries in entomology that you can find also here in Germany. And because of this very turbulent and long history we've had, we have been accumulating more than 3 million pinned insects. This 3 million estimation that is here was done in just a few years ago. So it's not the actual number. But besides the pinned and insect and dry insects, we also have the alcohol collection. And among them, we have more than 25,000 type specimens of different groups. And because of this long history also, we've been gathering and accumulating more than 100 collections. What does that mean? It means that different collectors throughout time, they've been selling, donating, depositing their specimens in our institute. So we became a very big institute also because of that. And nowadays, Coleoptera is the group, is the beetle order, comprises around 40% of the diversity of these insects, which are deposited here. And around one, you know, like, and we can, we have around 1.7 million specimens, and around 160,000 species. And among them, we have around also 14,000 to 13,500 types. So it is a very big collection, and it is a lot of work to digitize all of it. So 2 years ago, we had this AD call. AD call was it's like some funds that were offered by the group Senkenberg to actually promote digitization of different collections within it. And we got the CAREB project through, where it focused on digitization and standardization of the collection of CAREB beetles. This would comprise digitization of this group, which is present in different collections of Senkenberg. I'm sorry, I forgot to mention, but Senkenberg has institutes all over Germany. So in this project, we had Dresden, Mönchenberg, and Frankfurt collections included in this project. Their goal was to digitize the types. So take pictures and make this information available online. So this was mostly a pilot project and was supposed to last only for 2 years. And the idea was to create a workflow to maximize the accessibility and also to understand basically what does it take to digitize a big collection. So here you, on the right side, you have some pictures of our collection. You can show it's a very good installation. We have room control, the temperature controlled rooms. We have compactors, automatic compactors. Also the room is white, allowing to see any piece of information, any material that is on the floor is easy to see. So, and in this collection, we have more than, you know, we have more than 100 collections inside it from different collectors. So before starting this digitization, we had to gather all these individual collectors' collections into one. And during the process of the merge under the Senkenberg name, we had this inventory. We had to take pictures of everything we had inside the building. So for our collection, we had we took pictures of every drawer, and also we added labels so we can identify which kind of collection was it and how many drawers we had. So at the end, we had pictures. We have an inventory of biological collection specimens and fossils. So the first step was basically to mount all this collection. As I said, we had many collections assembled in one before we started this. So we had to mount all the specimens. Many specimens were in poor condition with very bad label. So we had to mount each individual that we had before starting this. So once we had the pictures of all the drawers, we had a sort of an idea or an estimation of the number of species, the number of specimens, and the number of types, which was our actual focus, to digitize the types first. But before doing this, we also had to assess the validity of these names, because very often the names that were in the drawers, they were old names, they were outdated taxonomy. So we had to do a taxonomic assessment first before we go to the next step, because we don't want to put the old names or synonym names inside a database. So what we did, we took pictures of all these drawers, and Dr. Lutz Banner, which was a technician and still works in the institute, he went through, focusing on carabids, of course, we went through all the drawers and reassessed the validity of each name. So for example, here you had in the drawer the name of the species, and then he indicates it's a synonym. And synonym, for those who don't know, is basically a name that was described after the first time the species was described. But it describes the same species, but with a different name. So it is important to know which ones are the synonyms, because you don't want to describe the same species twice. And not only this, we also assess different status of the species. For example, in this case, we had a species that is actually a subspecies. And moreover, we had to assess which ones are actually valid types in the collection. So go through all these drawers and actually understand whether or not this species, this specimen, is the type that is supposed to be in the collection. So we went through all of these taxonomic corrections, and very often we would go through different collectors. Sometimes we wouldn't have the pictures for the drawers, because the labels were very much together, one to the other. So pictures would not be very useful in this case. So we had to go manually through each drawer and indicate and find which ones are the species or not. So after that, we can input this data into our database. So as a database here, we use Paradox, which is an outdated database, but it's very useful. And in this database, we have a code for each suborder, a code for each family group. As you can see here, you have 40 associated with the name Adephaga, 50 associated with the name Polyphaga, and so on. And here you also have a family name. A family also has numbers, and the subfamily. But the species and the genus name, actually, they comprise of a system code, which is associated in another window inside the database, where you have a list of synonyms available for each species. So it is a very useful database, and it has a lot of information. So from this database, we also can obtain a form, where this form has all this information that I just mentioned. So it has a name, the valid name for the genus, the synonyms that are available for that certain species. It has the name of the type that is actually valid. You have the subspecies that is valid. You have the name of the author and the year of the author. And the labels that we use inside the drawers, they follow this database structure. So you can simply input this data and print this in our labels, which facilitates a lot the work of our technicians. So basically the label contains the name of the subspecies, the name of the species, the genus. On this rectangles here at the bottom, you also have this information that you have on the top, and I will explain later why. On this right bottom side, you have the total number of specimens that you have of that species, and from which collections we actually gather this material from. So here, for example, it means the main collection has 1,302 exemplars, but then the collection of Weber contributed 25 exemplars for this total. The collection of K contributed 794 for this total. So the sum of these collections will give this number. And it's very interesting to actually have this associated with the specimen, because then you know where the specimens came from. As you can, this also will allow you to trace the history of the specimen. And also very important is the indication of the geographic region where the species is from. So we have this code for different geographical regions, Neotropics, Palearctic, Nearctic, and so on. So after having this, we can also put the labels inside the new drawers. So we have new drawers, but most often, new drawers because we have unit trace system. So unit trace systems are this little box that we put inside the drawer and allows us to easily move each species if necessary. So inside the drawer, we place the label in the front, and the rectangle that I mentioned in the previous slide allows us to do the following. So when you actually take the drawer from the storage, you can see the name of the species, you can see the name of the subspecies, or any all this information you can see from top and from the laterals. So this helps a lot once you are moving the material in the collection. And you don't have to take completely the drawer from it. So this helps a lot in our work. Not only this, we also organize the material with the valid species, the species that are correctly identified facing forward, and the ones that are in doubt, we put them facing backwards. This also facilitates, once you are in the collection and you're working with a certain species, you can easily assess the ones that are correct or not, or we are in doubt. And besides that, we also organize our collections or the specimens in order of collectors. So we put the oldest collectors, the types in the first rows, as in here, and the following, they follow the timeline of collectors that contributed to this, the amount of specimens in the collection. So how did we assess, the idea is to take pictures of the types and make them available for anyone that wants to use it. So how did we do this? Well, in the past, we had some technicians that went through the collection and actually gathered this information saying, what's the name of the type? What's the literature associated with this? If the type is a male, female, is it a holotype, is it a primary type, is it a secondary type? So all this information was in a file like this, and then we transferred this information into our database. And then after knowing which ones, which types we had and which ones are the primary types, we made a table which is used to actually say which types are we supposed to take pictures of, because we focus on the primary types. So after having this information, we take pictures of the types. And this is a very laborious and very time-consuming activity, because we have not only to take pictures, it's not simply taking the specimens and putting under the camera. So first, we have two different systems for different size of specimens. We have the Leica system, which is a camera associated with a microscope. And we have the workstation Nikon, which is a automatic stacking system where you set the top part and the bottom part of the picture, and then it automatically makes the stack. But we also have to take the labels that are placed under the specimen so we can scan them. And we also have to clean the specimen. So it is very time consuming. And not only this, the type pictures are stored in our hard drive, an external hard drive in the institute. So, so as I said, we take pictures of the specimens, and the labels, we actually scan them. And when we make the scanning of the labels, we also add a number from our system to the specimen, and then the name of the specimen also receives this number, so we can easily find this in our database. So it's And then after, of course, taking the picture also needs to be processed in a way where you have to rename the photos, you have to add the scale bar, you have to replace the specimen in the correct place. So it's a very time-consuming work. And it's really not easy and not cheap. This is our technician. She has been working in the project since the beginning. And here is just a very few steps, which you, when you look, you think, wow, that's doable and easy, but it's actually not. As I just described to you, you can kind of get an idea of how laborious it can be. And here's just a few numbers so you can understand how hard it is. So this project total costs around 250,000 euros. We have 260,000 specimens. And more than 3,000 types. It takes around one person to, and I put 7 boxes there, but it's basically to transfer around 600 specimens per week. And one person to take takes like around a week to take pictures of 50 specimens. But from the beginning of this project, we didn't have one technician and a half like we have nowadays. We still have a student helper, but we only have one technician, and this technician was not only responsible for this digitization process, but also for other duties like answering mails of loans and requests. So this project, it was supposed to be a pilot at the beginning, but it's lasting for more than 2 years, and we hope to finish this by December of this year. That's the aim. So let's see if we can get there. And the output. So the goal is to make this data accessible. But after this, when we go and look for the accessibility that this has provided, not yet we have achieved the goal. Here we have the Global Biodiversity Information Facility, which is a I don't know if all of you are aware, but it's a database. It's a cooperation between different countries and international institutions with the aim of promoting and making available online access on planetary biodiversity. So this would serve for research, conservation, sustainable development. And here you can see the backbone of this database, where only 51% of the names of the species for insects is actually available, and less than 50% of it has data on it, contains data. The GBIF is a very interesting and important initiative, but it contains many mistakes, and it's a very incomplete database still. Hopefully in the future with more development it can improve. But there are many mistakes such as misidentifications that different institutes put information that is incorrect into it. So it has also non-specific data record. Very often you have specimens that don't have locality and don't have distribution records available to it, and then it's a known specific record available in GBIF. The species status was not updated before being added to it. And there are also database miscrossing. So here I have a quick example where this genus, Mesomphalia, I worked with it during my master's thesis. And here I basically say that this species had 3 names available in the past for it, so the synonyms, as I said before. But when you go to GBIF, the name associated as a synonym for this species is a completely different name. It was never available. So this is a very common situation, especially in entomology, because the diversity is really big, and we don't have complete, we don't have the sharing of the data that we're gathering from collections into these databases, or fully a taxonomic assessment. So there's a lot of problems with this database. And at the end, the problem, the lack of data in this big databases takes us to a little bit of a bias also in the scientific fields, where you see entomology from 2000 to 2010. This is a very quick assessment of some numbers that I gather from Web of Science. This was absolutely not exhaustive at all. It was just some numbers that I could show you, where before 2010, we had 225 papers, mostly in the Journal of Medical Entomology, associated mostly with medical entomology, in the field of spatial ecology, which uses occurrence data as the main kind of data. And as you can see in GBIF, it's not really available entomological data. So I did a search associated entomology and some of the words associated with this field. And you can see that in the past was mostly the species that actually had medical importance, that were more closely related to the interests of the human beings, like their health. You could see that there were many papers taking care of it, like actually talking about it. But then in 2010 to 2020, there was an increase of sharing data, and we had an increase of 100%. And you can actually see the change a little bit. So other fields besides public health actually were interested in using this data that was more publicly available. And you can see a change a little bit of the kind of journal that was publishing this kind of data and this kind of studies. So ecology, evolution were a little bit more, so they could use more because species that were not only associated with public health were actually being explored in these databases. But when you compare entomology with other groups, you see that there is a huge bias. In the past, American Naturalist, which is a journal on ecology, a very high-ranked journal in ecology, was already leading the field, sort of, because for other groups, this kind of information, distributional data especially, was already way more available than it was for entomology. And the increase from 10 years ago to now was more than 200%. So here you can see there is a clear bias, and you might say, well, Mariana, but you are comparing entomology with all the other groups. But if you think that entomology is like 50% of all eukaryotes, you kind of think that it's a little bit reasonable to make this comparison. And then patterns like this, such as the insect decline that we're suffering now, we remain kind of neglected, in the sense that we don't have the enough tools and enough information to tackle them and understand the patterns that we see now and the patterns that we might see in the future. So what we need to actually to tackle this is a little bit more investments, new tools. So for example, unique identifiers, which help us to associate the same species from database A, database B, database C, from different museums. Digitization, better tools for digitization. Here you have a GigaPen, which was a photograph method to actually take pictures of drawers, high resolution pictures of drawers. And it has there has been more development on that field, but we need more investment and better development. We need more workforce. We need people investment into technicians that actually allow us to tackle the problem of the amount of work and amount of specimens that we have in our collections. And most important, as you can see here, we need investment. So here's a few data, a little bit of data from Cardozo 2011, where it makes an estimation of arthropods to be 82% of all diversity. Then you have total investment per taxon, which was only 88% of all this to arthropods. And the average funding per species was absolutely infamous in comparison with groups such as mammals, birds, and amphibians, or fish. So this is something that must change. Also, we need better databases. Nowadays, we have different databases for different museums, different universities. Some of them are open source, some of them are not. Like Excel, many of them just collect metadata on Excel, which is great, but there are others like certain Darwin core fields that are not met in these databases. And not only this, we need someone to create a database that can unify all of this and connect all of this, but also maintain them. Because, for example, our database, Paradox, it's a great database. It allows us to do many things. But the manufacturer actually stopped making updates, and now we don't have the last version. We don't have a version that allows us to share this information. So that's why our data is not actually available online. And now currently we're actually waiting Senkenberg to manage the databases. I'm about to finish. The databases available inside the institute. And not only this, we need space. Because when we do digitization and we reorganize the collections, this is what happens. We increase from 1 to 3 to 10 to 20. And then all the space that we used to have, and they end up end up missing a lot of space because of reorganization and improvement of the infrastructure inside the drawers or outside the drawers. So basically with that, I finished my talk. I hope I could elucidate a little bit of the problems and challenges, the utility of the data that we have. And I'm very happy and glad to take any questions.